The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening, everyone. Is this volume okay for everyone? Is this good? So I didn't know I was supposed to be here today. Somehow the scheduling happened such a way that I didn't know it so much. And then I see someone texted me 20 minutes ago and said that I looked at the schedule, and sure enough, there I am. So I'm happy to be here, but I think that we're going to have to do this together. I don't have a talk to give. Not anything that maybe you want to hear. So, at the moment. So, there's a few things we could do. One is, you could just, the classic thing is you could ask questions. I was home with my wife just now, and I said, oh, there's no one to be there, and I'm scheduled to be there, and what do I do? And she said, well, you can just go do questions. And then I said, okay, I'll go. And so we could do that, or I could ask you questions, but that might be scary. So what would you like to do? Or you have other options, but those are the two I can think of.
Question.
Sorry?
Questions.
Okay, let's see if you have any questions, and I'll do my best to respond or ask a question in return. Maybe we can maybe pass out the mic. We'll be ready with it if it's someone.
Test. Always have lots of questions.
Can you do it a little louder for me?
I'm very new to all of this.
Sorry?
I'm new to all of this, but one question lately has been, what is the role of fun?
The role of?
Fun. Having fun.
Oh, fun!
Just fun, pleasure. How do we work that into improving?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the fun. Some people find this practice to be quite fun, believe it or not. I don't think I associated with fun, but the greatest happiness, the greatest joy that I've ever had in life in a long, sustained way is through this practice. I've been on retreat for months, and it was kind of like nonstop joy, just kind of ecstasy. So was that fun? I don't know if that's exactly fun, but it was kind of unsurpassable kind of joy that was wonderful. So that can happen that way. This morning I had a conversation with someone about grief in this practice, in Buddhism. Is there a place for grief? Because it's in the ancient texts, it seems like there's no real place for grief. Grief is something to overcome. And there's no mention of fun. There's a little bit of mention of play. But there's no mention of fun either. And so does that mean that this is like a really flat tradition, and the only thing you're allowed to do is sit and close your eyes and be quiet, and just deal with it? Or is there fun? Is there grief? What are the range of things a human person can do? And now I'm speaking for myself rather than for Buddhism, is that I'm not that interested. I'm not looking to Buddhism to tell me how I'm supposed to be. I'm looking at Buddhism to inspire me to look deeply at what is happening to me. So if I have having fun, I don't have any idea that Buddha should have fun or should not have fun. I'm just having fun. And then the practice of mindfulness is for me to look at that as I'm doing it. And there's ways in which I'm attached to some things, ways in which something unwholesome or unhealthy is coming out in that fun. And if it is, then I'd like to stop that. But if it's not, then I'd like to keep doing it. I don't see any reason not to. Fun is fun. So the same thing with grief. If I feel grief, I don't really care whether the ancient tradition has no room for grief. It's just supposed to really matter, just overcome it and not have it. And it's a complicated question what the ancient tradition really says and what it means, and scholars are, you know, looking into this, try to tease apart, because we're talking about a language that no one speaks anymore from 2,500 years ago, and to understand exactly where these kind of crucial questions are played out is a topic. But I'm not so interested, even with grief or anger or anything, to judge it automatically as I should or shouldn't be that way. If I'm having it, then it's real. And if it's real, I want to see it. I want to know it more deeply. I want to see what's going on. And I want to see if there's something unwholesome, unhealthy in the way that I'm engaged in it. Am I attached? Am I clinging to something? And if I'm clinging to something, then for me, it is... I'd rather not. But if I'm not clinging, whether it's fun or grief or whatever it might be, if I'm not causing any harm to myself or others, then I'm fine with it. So that's not answering your question directly, but it's offering you a Buddhist principle, which is be mindful of when you're having fun. And see what it's like. See what's going on. So it's probably not a satisfying answer. But if you want to ask again, or maybe you want to say why you're asking.
I think at the center of it is that question of I should or shouldn't. And behavior based off of let me have this clear cut, I should do this or I should do that. But I think your answer to me kind of says that there isn't a this or a that, that it's an investigation of each thing. And just, again, that mindfulness approach of when I recognize what I'm calling fun, what's there? Is there attachment? Is this something, is it behavior that is moving towards what I want to be?
Uh-huh.
Or is it behavior that's moving towards something else?
Great, yeah, so I think you understood what I had to say, yeah. So shoulds and shouldn'ts are not as interesting as looking deeply. And if you look deeply, then you maybe have an answer to whether you should or shouldn't. You know, if you see that it's causing harm to you, maybe then you shouldn't do it. Or it's causing harm to others, maybe you shouldn't do it. But you don't start with that premise. You start with investigation. Great.
Thank you.
Yes, if you
could. Hi.
And if you could say your name, I'd love to know.
Sure. I'm Teresa. Teresa.
Treva.
Teresa.
Like Teresa, yeah. It's hard with the masks and everything, and my hearing is not so good. So if you could turn it up a little bit, because my hearing is a little hard. I also went swimming. It's that evening, and so I think there's a little bit of water in there.
So I've been on a journey. So I have been meditating for maybe like 3 years now.
Uh-huh.
But still, like, and I noticed there's been like phases in my psychology, and like kind of like observing myself, and seeing how I react to things. And I'm still kind of going through phases. And I was kind of curious, since you're taking questions, in your journey in this practice of mindfulness, have you kind of been through a similar journey of like the evolution of your psyche, like going from like right now I'm observing my tendencies, and then now I'm like watching myself in action,
uh-huh.
and trying to observe those actions, and then I noticed I've been kind of just like shifting in my perception, and then it influences my actions. But anyway, uh-huh. I'm still like kind of in the mix of it all.
Yeah, wonderful.
And I was actually really curious, for somebody who's been practicing for longer and deeper, uh-huh. and kind of way more, progressed. I was curious if there was like a progression or like some sort of like phases or like trends of like observation.
Yeah.
And then where did you end up? I mean, I'm sure it's still a journey, but like now when you practice, are you just kind of going back to center, and like, do you feel like you're going to different states of consciousness? Where, I mean, samadhi is like kind of like, you know, like a big, huge thing. But I'm just kind of curious, like how has evolved and gone toward that.
Wonderful, yeah. So the I love the very much the metaphor of journeying, the unfolding, the evolution of practice, and I find that the stories that people tell or the teachings that kind of lay out an arc of practice inspiring to me. And yes, I've had all kinds of journeys, arcs, phases in my practice. I probably wouldn't have worded it the way you worded yours, but it's always going to be personal. So I was delighted to hear the things that you were mentioning. And so what I can affirm for you is, yes, there are phases, and what you describe are good phases to go through. And there's a lot more. There's some more that are more classic for Buddhism, and some which are very personal, aren't really part of. I wouldn't say they're not part of Buddhism, but they're not really classically discussed or something. But one of the interesting things to the shifts over time that makes an interesting study is how does your interests shift over time? How do your perceptions shift over time? How does what you tend to notice in yourself and the environment shift over time? How does your motivation shift over time? And these all will unfold and change. And sometimes intentionally so, it's like this is what we want to see the change and we move towards it. Sometimes, it's a surprise how we change. But if you do this practice, you will change. So is that... You can welcome to ask more specifically, because I'm not sure I touched exactly what you wanted to...
Yeah, I guess I was curious if there were like... like, what are the arcs? And I guess we don't have to sit here listening to, like, the whole uh-huh. scripture. But, like, was there, like, very striking, like, clear, like, where did it take you on your journey? And how did that help you, evolve?
Uh-huh. I've been doing this for almost 50 years, so there's been a lot. I could cover a lot over this time. It's still unfolding. When I was a beginner, I was introduced to meditation at first, and it was kind of nice for me, and it wasn't Buddhist meditation, but it was nice to do. And then it was in college, and then I had summer vacation, and then I stopped meditating. And then later, about 9 months later, I was introduced to Buddhist meditation, through Zen meditation. And I wasn't really caught by the meditation, but I was interested in some of the teachings that I read about. And then it took a little... I got serious about doing it, but I felt like... So I was ready to really give myself over to Zen practice. But I didn't feel like it was the right phase in my life for it, to give it myself over to it in a big way. And so I felt like I had to take care of loose ends in my life. I was 20 or 21. And so one of the loose ends was, I'm from Norway, and I didn't grow up a lot in Norway, but I had this uncertain relationship with. And so I thought, before I, you know, I need to go back and resolve my relationship to the country, what, you know, where I should live and things like that. So I went back to Norway for a year. And then eventually I came back to the United States to continue college. And I was suffering. And I had this idea that if I meditated, started Zen meditation, it would help me deal with the suffering I had. So I started meditating every day, twice a day. And something shifted for me after a few months of meditating. And that is, I discovered I was meditating for no reason. And I'm kind of a rational guy, and so it was kind of strange for me to not have a reason to do what I did, but I was going to do it anyway. There was no question about it. You know, there was something in me that was motivated, but I didn't know why. Why am I doing this? You're doing it. And so I thought about it for a while, and I came up with the two things I kind of began to realize was happening to me. One was that I wasn't doing meditation for a reason, any more than a musician plays music for a reason, or a dancer dances, or an artist paints. It's a kind of an expression in the moment, and it's not so much to get through the music as fast as you can. It's to express something in the music or the dance, something. So I thought, yeah, I'm not doing it for a reason, but it's a form of. It was the fullest kind of self-expression I discovered, I knew. And that was so meaningful for me. And as that became clear, then I felt what I was experiencing was integrity. And later I realized, I don't think I meant moral integrity, ethical integrity. I think what I meant back when I was 21 or something, a sense of wholeness I was developing that I hadn't had before. And that sense of wholeness then changed my trajectory of my life. So first I had it in meditation, and that was really nice. And then I discovered that, then I had this question, well, Gil, the line between meditation and daily life is an arbitrary line. Why do you only be this way in meditation? So I said, I want to be able to do this integrity thing in the rest of my life as well. And so that's when that's the reason I moved to live at a Buddhist center. And so I lived there. I lived at the San Francisco Zen Center for a number of years. And in this quest to kind of be more integrated with this wholeness, be able to live it in my everyday life, paradoxically, I kept going. I went deeper and deeper into the monastic life, more and more meditation. But it wasn't exactly I wanted to meditate more yet. I just wanted to somehow expand into my life. And then, but in the process of all that, there's all these phases, right? So in the process of all that, I began seeing my psychology, my neurosis, the social games I played. And it became more and more obvious, you know, the oddities, the foibles of my mind. And I really was motivated to then work with them. And like in the monastery, one of them that I saw painfully was how much I wanted people to like me. And I was doing this social gymnastics to get everyone to like me. And I was the manager of the kitchen, managing a kitchen crew, and that's like the last place you want to be if you need to have people like you. And so it was really hard, and so it was exhausting. And after I you know, and one of the ways wisdom works is get wise. If you do something long enough to see the suffering of it. So I saw the suffering of wanting people to like me, and how it was overrated. And then because I was meditating a lot, it was a very interesting juxtaposition between seeing the suffering of this psychological complex of wanting people to like me, and feeling I was ready to let go of it, But I go and meditate, and meditation, I have this feeling of wholeness and goodness and deep, something deep, deep satisfying feeling of just being alive, kind of. And so that going back and forth between that, between this radical alternative to wanting people to like me, and this, there was kind of like reconditioning me. Whatever conditioning I had growing up that was difficult, that led me to want everyone to like me, in meditation, that was being reconditioned by this. Something was changing and shifting for me. And anyway, so I know that I could go on all night for 50 years and tell you, but that's what comes to mind, the kind of beginning years of the thing. So is that relatable for you?
Yes, very much. Thank you so much.
But it's definitely a good journey. It's definitely a wonderful thing to go through the phases it's one of the greatest things in my life is to have done doing this practice and you know where it's taken me and brought me and the things I've discovered and got to see and it's been the greatest thing.
Thank you.
So this is kind of actually a segue, I think, that will move on from Teresa's question. I actually happened to be listening to a Dharma talk that Norman Fisher gave at Green Gulch today while I was walking my dog. And he started talking about you.
Oh.
And he was saying that he was talking about how you received Dharma transmission in Zen, but now you're a Vipassana teacher. And as someone who kind of has like a foot in both camps myself, I'm kind of curious about what made you ultimately kind of make this commitment to be a Vipassana teacher rather than a Zen teacher.
Oh, because of all your students. Clearly, all these people who came to practice and were wanting to get Vipassana teachings from me, and they were such sincere practitioners, and it was so clear that how good it was to be. That had a lot to do with it, my idea of as you know, I came to go to Stanford in 1990, and I was also being trained to be a Vipassana teacher then, and I was still doing Zen training, and there was a small sitting group in Palo Alto, and I was asked to take it over and be kind of a teacher for it, and that group grew and grew, and my plan was at some point it was growing, and I said, okay, I think the plan is to, I want to grow it big enough so that I can invite in another teacher and I can leave. I wanted to live in the country someplace. But then I've been now here 32 years, so I haven't left yet. But at some point it became clear through about 7 years that I wasn't going anywhere because I felt a commitment to the people who were here and practicing, so we had a meeting where I wanted them to know that I was making a commitment to be a teacher for the group, but I didn't have any expectations or requests. I just wanted them to know that's what I was making, this big life decision. So at that meeting, I said that, and then somehow the meeting kind of quickly unfolded to it, we should get a center. And so then we started this process to buy this place, and it took about 5 years to do it. So that's not your question. The question is the Zen Vipassana thing. Well, Norman Fisher, he has a dual allegiance too, you know. Did he confess in that talk?
Oh, he did not.
Oh.
I hope he's listening on YouTube.
He's deeply immersed in Judaism. And I don't know exactly what his connection to Judaism, but I think he's very deeply connected in his heart. And his best friend until he died was a rabbi. And so this idea of being in two traditions, there's lots of room for that in Buddhism. So to be more specific to your question, I never made a... In the early years of doing this, I didn't make a definitive decision to... I loved Zen. I really had no trouble with it. I felt very at home in it. I was ordained as a Zen priest. And it worked really well for me. But then we had back in the 1980s, there was a whole slew of Buddhist teachers who had ethical challenges, to say it politely. And there was the abbot of San Francisco Zen Center was one of those. And so when he that kind of freed me up from Zen Center to go, and I went to Japan to practice in Japan. But while I was in Japan, when I got my airplane ticket to go to Japan, I knew I had to leave Japan after some months to get a new visa. And I discovered that for $25 more, I can get it, than it would cost a round trip ticket from San Francisco to Japan, I could get a round trip ticket to Bangkok with free stopovers in Japan, both ways. And since I knew I had to leave Japan to get the visa, new visa, I thought that's really cheap, $25 to go get out. Come and so I got a round trip ticket to Bangkok. So after being in Japan for about 3 months, I worked in monasteries there, and I flew to Bangkok, and I knew that. I was a Zen priest then, and I was beginning to have conversations with people who had meditation experiences I hadn't had. And if, I didn't feel like I needed to have them, but as people coming to talk to me, I felt I needed to know the map of practice. And I knew that in Thailand, the map of practice was in some ways much more clearly laid out than they ever do in Zen. So I thought, while I'm waiting for my visa, I'll go visit different the monasteries and talk to the teachers and find out that map. But then I decided when I got there, no, I'm just going to go to one monastery and just say, I'm here, tell me what to do. And so I had a little address for a dog-patched little meditation monastery on the edges of Bangkok. Dog-patch means kind of archaic and pigs running around and all kinds of interesting things going on. And I showed up, and the teacher said, okay, here's a little hut for you to live in. And all day long, you just do sitting meditation and walking meditation and come and talk to me in the morning. And it's okay. So I was happy to do that. And so I was waiting for the visa to come. And it took me 10 weeks to realize, the visa's not coming. And then I realized, I could go back to Japan now, and I'll get another 6 months. Without a visa or something, so I can, to finish my year there. But those 10 weeks, it was like a 10-week retreat, and I'd never sat in silence that long. The most I'd sat in Zen is 7 days, so to do it for 10 weeks was a bit, and I got more concentrated than I ever been before. And I touched something inside that I'd never touched before, and it became essential to touch that again. And it was kind of when I left, there was kind of a dark night of the soul time. I went back to the United States, but all I could think about was go back, because I didn't know anywhere else to touch that place again except through that practice. And so as quickly as I could, I worked at a restaurant, fast food restaurant, for a while to earn the money. And when I had the money, I went back. And this time I knew that the meditation practice I had studied in Thailand came from Burma. So I decided to go up to the headquarters, the source. I wasn't leaving Zen. It was just like, it was just accidentally set a 10-week retreat. It made an impression on me that changed me. I had no choice but to continue with it. So I did, and that was, next retreat was 8 months long. And that made a huge impact on me. It was a life-changing event for me. And then I came back to Zen Center. And actually, I didn't come back. What happened was, in those 8 months, I hope I'm not boring you. It's okay? Stories like this? So at San Francisco Zen Center is where I practiced. But when I was on that 8-month retreat, I got really, really quiet and deep and still. It was really, you know. And then I would still have these little thoughts. And I had thoughts about Zen Center and positions in Zen Center and advancement in Zen Center and this teacher at Zen Center. And, you know, it was all these Zen Center intrigue kind of thoughts. And I said, Gil, what in the world? How in the world did Zen Center get into the depth of your psyche? And I made a vow, I'm not going to go back to Zen Center until I have Zen Center out of my mind. So I went back, came back to, I was from Burma, and I wasn't planning to be back at Zen Center, but I had a girlfriend, and she really wanted to live at she had psychological challenges, and so she really wanted to live at Zen Center, and so I went back to Zen Center to live with her. And then I stayed for another year and a half, and then I went, and then I was ready to go back and continue with the Vipassana practice. And so I went to the 3-month retreat at IMS. But by that time, they wanted me to come be a Shuso, the head monk at Tassajara. It's kind of like a rite of passage for just in the cusp of being a Zen teacher. And I didn't have anything going. You know, I wasn't like I had a career or. It wasn't like I had ambitions. You know, I just wanted to practice. And so I was delighted to go back and be this head monk. And then it felt enough. I'd done 10 years of intensive practice, monastic practice. So then I thought, I need to figure out, it doesn't make sense to go back to Zen Center. It makes sense now to find, but what am I going to do? I'm a Zen priest. I'm dedicated to the Dharma, that's what I want my life to be about. And how am I going to make a living? Or what am I going to do? And so I decided I would get a master's in religious studies, specializing in Buddhism, so that I could teach in a community college, like an intro class to Buddhism. So I went to get a master's. And while I was there, Jack Kornfield called me up. And I hardly knew him. I'd met him once. Talked to him on the phone once, and he invited me into his teacher training. And then I had this very strange, can't hear. This is.
Just boost the volume.
Did the sound change somehow? Is it in the better now?
Yeah.
So, it was a remarkable experience. Jack Kornfield invited me to be in teacher training. I was standing, kind of looking out a window. And it was like I felt this click, 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 like the pieces of the puzzle of my life came together. It's like, wow. So of course I said yes. I mean, who wouldn't say yes to that, to study with Jack, to be a teacher like that? I wasn't really thinking so much that I would be a teacher, maybe. I don't know what I was thinking, but I just like, this is right. And then I came back to the Bay Area and was living at Zen Center and studying with Jack. And so it was like I was always in and out. It wasn't like I chose one or the other. And then I started studying to get Dharma transmission from Mel Weitzman, my Zen teacher. And he knew I was being trained to be a Vipassana teacher. And then at some point I got it's called Dharma transmission, authorization to be a Zen teacher. But usually the understanding is when you get this Dharma transmission in Zen, you're kind of responsible to pass the lineage on to the next person, like pass it down. But Mel gave me a Dharma transmission and he said to me, because I'm giving this to you with no expectation. You have this other path that I trust you, I trust what you're doing, and you do what you see is fit. And then so I wasn't living at Zen Center anymore. And being outside of Zen Center, they didn't really invite me back to teach much. I had something to do with them, but the Vipassana world invited me to do a lot of teaching. And so I entered into it. And I studied it a lot and studied the teachings, the early teachings of the Buddha. And I felt a strong affinity to it. And right now, I feel a strong affinity to these early teachings more than I do to the Zen teachings. And so what I say what I said to myself or say to people is that in a kind of way, Zen is my religion and Theravada or Vipassana is my practice. Is that kind of different? However, I'm not very interested in religion. I'm interested in the practice, and this is the practice tradition. I'm really practicing it now. But I love Zen, and I'm very grateful for it, and I stay connected to San Francisco Zen Center, and my gratitude for Zen Center is really great. So I have this commitment. If they ask me for something, I say yes. I try to say yes. So does that tell you kind of the convoluted story of my connection between the two?
Yeah, I've been so curious. So that was really interesting and super nosy. So. It's very satisfying. Thank you.
Someone else said something over here?
Did you have a question? Well, you kind of answered
it. I kind of answered it?
Yeah.
Okay.
I can just ask you,
go ahead with the mic though, because my poor hearing.
So you said you went swimming.
Can you hold it up? Kind of, yeah.
You said you went swimming earlier.
Yeah.
What's your relationship and connection to swimming and meditation? What do you see in the overlaps of those?
Oh. I know there's people who are swimmers who feel like that's what they do. They meditate. They get concentrated. They get absorbed, and just really right there with the swimming. I'm not a swimmer like that. I just swim because I enjoy swimming and I like the exercise. And I have a year and a half ago, I got a cataract surgery. And so now I can, for the first time in like 50 years or more, I can see when I'm in the water because it only, without glasses. And it's so wonderful to swim now in this lake up here that I outdoors in the lake, and I just like look around at the trees, and they have green herons sometimes there, and they have ducks, and I swim sometimes. It depends how I swim. If I'm crawling, I look around. It's so nice. And then I do the breast. Then I do no. When I do breaststroke, I look around. When I crawl, I don't look. So I just swim. And with this mindfulness practice that I do, it's kind of, I've done it so long that it's second nature for me. So no matter what I'm doing, I'm being attentive to what's happening with me. But I'm not using swimming as a means of concentration or getting quiet. Those are all great states. But the primary thing that I'm interested in these days in terms of phases, I've had so many wonderful states of mind and concentration states and all kinds of things, and they're great, but that's not the point. The point is not to suffer. It's to be and to be just to have some feeling of freedom, it's to be able to kind of have that freedom as a current, as a thread that goes through everything we do. And so I'm swimming, and one of the primary practices I do, whatever I'm doing, including swimming, is it could be summarized by a simple question. Am I suffering? And if I am, then I stop and take a good look at that. Then I practice with that. But if I'm not suffering, if I'm having fun, I'll just continue doing what I'm doing. And I think swimming is fun. Is that how's that answer for you?
I mean, every answer so far has been amazing, so I can't complain.
Great. Maybe if we have one more, maybe time for one more question, if anyone would like to ask or comment or. You want to ask? Oh, you have a question from chat. Great. Can we have the mic back so that maybe Sveta can read it?
So we have a question from Robin. I have a question. Could you speak about setting intentions at the start of your meditation practice?
Can I speak about using intention at the start of meditation?
Setting intention.
Setting intention at start of meditation practice. Yeah, it's some people, I've done it, and it's some people find it tremendously helpful to be conscious about the intentions that you live by. One of the questions, one of the ways I've understood, one of the things I learned from Zen practice is that to be investigating, considering, what is my deepest intentions? And it was 1 year that, what's the deepest intention you want to live your life by? Don't take your life for granted. Kind of reflect, and what's the deepest heart wish or the deepest thing that you want to do? And so this deep intention, so to live that intentionally, maybe, why not follow your deepest intention? Are you scared? Do you have some kind of ambition or greed for something else? But what about your deepest intention? I think it's one of the greatest resources we have. And I trust it very much. I keep asking question, what is in there? Is there something deeper than that? I spent a whole year asking that question every day. And it was phenomenally useful to do that. And there were phases that I went through asking that question every day. And so as we get in touch with some intentions that are important for us, then it's interesting at the beginning of meditation to remind oneself of that intention and then make that the context for why you're practicing. So, or it could be the deepest intention is the way to reach it is through becoming more concentrated or becoming more mindful or more clear. And so to set an intention at the beginning of a meditation is a little bit like setting a direction for yourself. But there's many ways of doing it, but the way that I found it most useful is to set the intention at the beginning and then don't think about it again. And it works a little bit like it sets the mood, sets the kind of general container for what we're doing. And so it's kind of like rather than going along merrily and the whatever motivations you were living your day by, and there's a real much bigger shift then to really be here intentionally to practice. But also it works a little bit like some people have the experience of going to sleep at night and saying to themselves, I'm going to wake up at 5 a.m. and without an alarm clock. And boom, at 5 a.m. they wake up. And so there's something about setting an intention going to sleep. The intention kind of can survive and live and be expressed somehow in the subconscious, that kind of offline because we're sleeping. So sometimes setting an intention in meditation can be the same thing. You set it, you set the direction, the course you're going, and then you don't think about it anymore, trusting that something has been set in place in the deep conscious parts of the mind. And then sometimes you'll be surprised about how it kind of is there to support you or guide you or open new things up. So I think it's a fun thing to do, to practice with intention. You don't want to get busy with it. Don't have too high expectations of what it can do for you. But it's a wonderful thing to do. So I hope that was okay. So, it's just about 9 o'clock. So thank you. And thank you for accommodating me and not coming with a talk. Maybe it was probably nicer. It was nice for me. So thank you for coming. And we're going to probably change the, for July, change the protocol for coming into for the sittings here Monday. So it'll be posted. I think you'll all probably get an email. You're probably all registered, right? And you get the email. So you'll be notified about the change. It'll be easier to come. And you probably will stop doing the sign up. So it'll change. It'll stay in July when we get to July. So thank you very much.